A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. We have made it to midweek. The weekend is in store, and maybe some rain time. We're supposed to get some snow here in Central Virginia on Friday, but I'm hoping Saturday is actually supposed to be pretty nice, so I'm hoping to head down to my shooting spot and put some rounds down range. All right. Today, we're going to be talking with Heritage Foundation's Amy Swearer about the Every Town for Gun Safety Gun Training Classes. And one of the statistics that the anti-gun group cites in its gun training, which really does seem like an opportunity to simply give prospective gun owners a lot of anti-gun talking points. Anyway, one of the statistics that they cite is a purported number of defensive gun uses in the United States. I wrote about this at Bearing Arms a couple of weeks ago. Rob Romano, as Amy mentions, pointed this out on X. Defensive gun uses are supposed to be incredibly rare, right? According to the gun control activists, hardly ever happen. Well, according to Every Town, about 69,000 defensive gun uses take place in the United States each and every year. Now, that is far below what other surveys have found, but it is far higher than the number of gun-involved homicides. In fact, it's far higher than the number of all homicides in general. So if defensive gun uses are rare, then murder is even more rare. I mean, it's just that is what it is. And again, at the Daily Signal, Amy Swearer has picked up on this as well. And a great conversation about Every Town's duplicitous language. Take a look and a listen. Amy, thanks so much for coming on the program. It's good to see you again.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's always good to be on with you.
And thank you for continuing the work that you're doing, in terms of supporting our Second Amendment rights. One of the great things that the Daily Signal is doing is keeping track of defensive gun uses. And I mean, this is something I do every day. We have a story on this podcast where we talk about defensive gun uses. But I got to say, I use you all as a source, because as much as I'm looking for these stories, sometimes I miss them. And I'll find, one or two that I didn't run across when you do your roundups. These incidents, these defensive gun uses are happening hundreds, if not thousands of times a day across the United States. And yet, gun control groups like Every Town say, no, defensive gun uses are extraordinarily rare, right? But in this new piece at the Daily Signal, you point out that even using Every Town's number of defensive gun uses, these are far from rare occasions.
Yeah, and this is great, right? Because this is just an example of the doublespeak and sort of duplicity that these groups will use. So Every Town, and I got to give credit to Rob Romano from FPC for highlighting this on Twitter, or I guess the app formerly known as Twitter. Credit to him for this. But Every Town apparently was doing a gun training for gun owners, like a gun safety, new gun owner training. And they accidentally said the quiet part out loud while not intending to, right? Because their whole shtick is, well, you don't really need a gun in the first place. Defensive gun uses are rare to begin with. But they never try to quantify, well, how rare is rare? Well, here they did. And it turns out, even by their number, which compared to basically every other study on this that has ever been done, which has this number in the millions of times a year, they're like, oh, it never happens. Just, 69,000 times a year, or, several tens of thousands of times a year, as though that is indicative of something that never happens. And it's doubly funny when you think about it, right? Because their other side of this is, well, we're just perpetually in a never-ending gun violence epidemic, right? It's an epidemic of gun murder, and that's why we need to take all the guns, right? Would you care to guess how many gun deaths there are in any given year in our just nefarious gun slaughter?
I think we might have lost...
That's happening all the time.
Oh, there you go. You locked up for a second there. I'll hazard a guess. We're talking about total gun deaths, right?
Total gun deaths.
Violent crimes and suicides combined, roughly what, 45,000?
Right, 45,000. So that is an epidemic, but 60,000 to 70,000 defensive gun uses. That's that never happens. That's a thing that never happens. So, look, I know I went to law school, not to math school, but I'm going to be honest, I can't make those numbers work out in every town's favor here. And also, the numbers are wrong. It's a complete undercount compared to every other study that's out there.
Yeah, I mean, the low end of studies that I've seen before every town, you know, cited 69,000. I think there was a DOJ study that said about 100,000 defensive gun uses every year. Gary Kleck's estimates as many as perhaps 2.5 million defensive gun uses every year. So, there is a wide range, but every town found a way to go even lower than the low end of the spectrum. And, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, in terms of homicides, I think we're less than 20,000 per year. And right now, I'm very curious to see what 2025's numbers are going to be, because it looks like homicides are dropping by 20% or more in many American cities. And that's a very good thing. So we could be looking at, 15,000 homicides per year. That's 15,000 too many.
Right.
But again, compared to 70,000 defensive gun uses that every town acknowledges, right? I mean, you put that in comparison. Defensive gun uses are more common than gun-related homicides. Why don't they ever talk about that? Because it completely undercuts their ideology.
Right, because then they would have to make the numbers make sense in their favor, and they wouldn't be able to do that. So it also makes sense why they've been a proponent of, wiping the government websites of anything related to defensive gun uses. When you look at what used to be on the CDC website, for example, and how in recent years under the last administration, they sort of wiped the entire page that dealt with defensive gun uses. Whereas it used to admit what the CDC admitted in 2013 under the Obama administration, that virtually every study on this shows that it's somewhere between 1 to 2, 2.5 million. And I think that number probably averages out at about 1.2, 1.3 million when you look at it.
Yeah. And again, that would include incidents where the gun is pulled but is never fired, right? Where the display of that firearm perhaps is enough to prevent a crime from going forward. Not every defensive gun use, in fact, I'd say the vast majority of defensive gun uses don't involve an assailant being shot and killed.
Right. And that's a good thing, right? Absolutely. That means you're not even having to pull that trigger, right? You're not having to go through, because let's be real, shooting someone, even in justified self-defense, is traumatic. So it's a good thing that the threat of that gun is sufficient to stop that potentially deadly, dangerous situation in its tracks. And what's interesting to me is if you look even deeper into some of this training that every town was giving, you just run into even more problems about their philosophy of some of this. For example, like they think it's a problem, apparently, that, in most of these scenarios, I think they throw out the number 58% of them. Well, the perpetrator wasn't even armed. So, why did they need a gun in the first place? The perpetrator wasn't armed, as though hundreds of people aren't beat to death every year, according to FBI statistics, as though, potentially having three different offenders, only one of whom is armed, right? Somehow makes a difference. So again, I think so much of this just underscores how skewed their philosophy is and the way in which they choose to look at reality is.
Which makes their decision to offer gun safety training so odd, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a group that is, it is meant to prevent us from accessing our Second Amendment rights. Do you see them offering this, again, as skewed as it is, as full of anti-gun bias as it is, do you see them offering this online training as sort of an admission that, all right, guns are here to stay? Or is this an attempt to disguise themselves as a moderate group that isn't interested in taking away our Second Amendment rights?
Yeah, I think the charitable explanation is that it's a little bit of both. But certainly I think there is an element of them trying to present themselves as, well, look, we don't hate guns, we don't hate gun owners, we just want you to be safe. The problem is the way in which they do this and actually try to train gun owners undermines the truth of gun safety that sort of lies underneath, right? So the more absurd that they get with these, to turn off gun owners who might actually otherwise be willing to listen, right? When you start telling people, well, no, your gun has to be stored in a safe at all times with ammo separately and unloaded, because don't worry if an intruder breaks in. You know, he'll definitely give you time to load that gun up and make sure that you're armed by the time he gets to your room or your kid's room or what have you, right? Serious gun owners are generally going to sit there and be like, that's not why I bought the gun. I didn't buy that gun to not have it in the scenario. I needed it. And it gets in the way of, I think, the potentially good part of gun safety training, helping people think through, hey, you know, there might be times when that gun should really be in a safe and unloaded, right? If you or a child are going through, you know, or someone else in the house is going through a mental health crisis, right? Let's talk about that. Let's have a plan for what that looks like. And that's an important conversation to have that I think too many gun owners don't know how to have, you know, haven't been talked through. This is how we have that conversation. Mm-hmm. But when you're just so absurd in how you present even the most basic aspects of gun ownership to people, I think it turns off, unfortunately, a lot of people from having, you know, the good conversations that we as gun owners ought to be having. You know, because unfortunately, there are some gun owners who do need to be reminded, hey, maybe don't put your loaded gun under a couch cushion where your six-year-old can get it. Right. You know, or, you know, just some of the more absurd things that, you know, it hurts me that we have to have these conversations. But I think that's again, the unfortunate reality. These absurd situations get in the way of the good conversations we could be having.
I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, a part of that is when the gun control movement realized, okay, people don't like the phrase gun control, so let's rebrand ourselves as gun safety, right? Yeah. I think that's had maybe it was the intended consequence. I don't know. But I think one of the responses from gun owners is that the phrase gun safety can now be seen as a, you know, a bad thing, right?
Right. It's a bit of a red flag. Yeah.
Right. When there is, I mean, gun safety, there is legitimate gun safety. It's not taught or practiced or preached by gun control activists, but that doesn't mean that gun owners should ignore those things. And I think you're absolutely right. Again, when we talk about, you know, some of these tragic stories we see about individuals who do leave a firearm loaded, unsecured, well within reach of children, you know, that's irresponsible parenting, that's irresponsible gun ownership. And there is a conversation that needs to be had, but that doesn't involve keeping every firearm in your home locked up, disassembled, ammunition stored separately, right? You can't use it for self-defense, right? There is a happy medium in between those things. So, Amy, listen, I always appreciate you coming on the program. It's been too long. And, you know, I know you're a regular face on Capitol Hill testifying in support of our Second Amendment rights. I hope you have directions to the Virginia State Capitol in Richmond, because we're going to need your help. And I think that honestly, even with your help, I think there's a lot of bad new gun control laws headed our way in the Commonwealth next year.
Yeah, it is. As a Virginia resident myself, it is, I think, potentially looking at a long, dark night for our Second Amendment rights here. But hopefully, you know, we've got a couple Supreme Court cases related to firearms. Hopefully the Supreme Court keeps taking on some of these challenges to things like so-called assault weapons bans. You know, they've got one in front of them right now dealing with some of the post-Bruin, and I call them spite laws, basically saying, here's your concealed carry permit. It works absolutely nowhere. You know, here's your piece of paper that's useless. So hopefully in time, this starts being less of a worry because the courts are willing to better enforce that. But yeah, as it stands, it's an unfortunate situation for us.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Supreme Court's got two mag ban cases. They're hearing in conferences tomorrow, as a matter of fact, as well as a challenge to Cook County ban a so-called assault weapon. So I'm keeping my fingers crossed that they take, you know, a gun and magazine ban case as quickly as possible so that we can get a decision as quickly as possible and hopefully keep our segment rights at least somewhat intact in Virginia. Anyway, Amy, again, thanks very much for coming on the program. Hope we get a chance to do this again soon. And thank you again for everything you do.
Thank you, Cam. I always appreciate it.
My thanks to Amy for coming on the program. It's always good talking with her. It has been too long, but we'll have her back again here very, very soon. Right now, though, let's get to our good deed of the day, our recidivist report, our armed citizen story. We'll start, though, with our recidivist report, a case out of California. The San Jose area, actually Santa Clara County, where, you know, the former sheriff there, Lori Smith, convicted in a civil case of basically corruption in office. This was in the pre-Bruin days when Santa Clara County, under Sheriff Smith, most folks could not get a concealed carry license. In fact, when most folks applied, their applications either got thrown in the trash or kind of stuck in a drawer somewhere, according to testimony that we heard during trial. If you are a very important person, on the other hand, and you were perhaps willing to contribute goods or services to the sheriff's or to an independent committee endorsing the sheriff's reelection bid, or maybe to the sheriff's department itself, yes, you could get a rarely granted concealed carry license. Now, under, you know, shall issue law, Santa Clara County can't do that. So instead, it costs you almost $2,000 to get a 2-year carry permit in Santa Clara County. Yeah, I would love to see the DOJ Civil Rights Division go after the Sheriff's Department and the county supervisors for that as well. But so far, it hasn't happened. Meanwhile, much easier to just break the law and illegally acquire and carry a gun, which is what a 17-year-old is accused of doing. Charges to be announced for teen arrested in gang-related Black Friday Valley Fair mall shooting. Yeah, California's gun control laws couldn't stop this 17-year-old from illegally acquiring a firearm, not once but twice, because according to authorities, the 17-year-old with alleged gang ties was already on probation for a gun charge. Yeah. So, again, where's the efficacy of California's gun control laws? A 17-year-old gets a gun illegally. He's caught with that illegally owned firearm. He gets a slap on the wrist. And the message apparently that was sent was not a big deal. Once again, the teen allegedly evades California's draconian gun control laws, evades the state's draconian carry laws too, and illegally has a gun on him when he shot, again, allegedly 3 people at a mall in San Jose. San Jose Mayor Matt Mahan, according to ABC7 in San Francisco, calling for changes to state law, says that gang leaders are conscious of the lack of accountability for juvenile offenders in the criminal justice system. He says, I don't want to see the pendulum swing back all the other way, but it doesn't feel like we're in a pragmatic middle ground where we're handling the violent repeat youth offenders accountable for changing their lives. I agree with that, by the way. And I imagine I agree with very little that the mayor of San Jose has to say about crime and public safety. But he is right about that. I don't want to see 13, 14-year-olds locked up for the rest of their life either. I understand that the purpose of the juvenile justice system primarily is rehabilitation, right? We want to take these young individuals. We want to help them turn their lives around so they don't grow up to become adult offenders and repeat offenders. But in some cases, we're not going to be able to do that. And often, well, I would say often, but there's no shortage of cases where somebody who's 13, 14, 15 years old already has a rap sheet as long as their arm. They're already a repeat offender. They're already a prolific offender. What do we do then? At that point, at some point, you have to say, okay, we've tried rehabilitation. Didn't stick. Didn't work. So now our primary focus is going to be keeping you away from the public in order to protect the public from you. And sure, while you're here, we'll still work on you, and we expect you to work on you too, but it's not going to be through meeting with your probation officer once a month. It's not about, you know, doing community service or having a mentorship with somebody who shows up at your school once a week. Tried that. Didn't work. So now you're going to be kept behind bars for as long as we can hold you, which may be until you're 18, maybe until you're 21, but you're not getting out until then. And maybe we do need to start looking at prosecuting individuals as adults at an earlier age. I confess, I am a little squeamish about that. I think we can go too far. And to me, if you're going to charge somebody as an adult, we should treat them as an adult outside of the criminal justice system, which raises all kinds of sticky issues. But at the very least, we need a juvenile justice system that is not solely about rehabilitation, but also recognizes, again, that there are going to be juvenile offenders who do pose such a risk to public safety that they cannot and should not be out on probation. And unfortunately, that's not the case in Santa Clara County or most of the rest of the country either. All right, on to today's armed citizen story from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where a homeowner shot a suspected burglar during a home invasion in Dauphin County. This happened Sunday night. Susquehanna Township Police Department called to the home just before 11 p.m. after receiving reports that a suspect was shot during a burglary. Once on the scene, they provided life-saving care to the suspect, who was identified as a 34-year-old Anthony Diemler of Harrisburg. Diemler was taken to a local hospital for treatment. At this point, the extent of his injuries is unknown. The police department is still investigating the burglary slash home invasion with the help of the Dauphin County forensics team. Police said there's no known threat to the public. Diemler, charged with two felony counts related to burglary, as well as a misdemeanor count of loitering and prowling at nighttime. We don't have really a lot of information about, you know, the armed resident of the home, or how they even, you know, discovered that Diemler was breaking in. But again, we do know that the police are viewing this as a case of armed self-defense there in the Harrisburg suburbs. So we'll keep our eyes open for any more information and bring it to you as it becomes available. Finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A good Samaritan in Florida who helped save a woman from an oncoming train. We've got a lot of good Samaritan stories out of California, or out of Florida, it seems, recently. Not California, but out of Florida. Yesterday, we had one out of the Miami area. This one from Hallandale Beach in Broward County. Police body camera footage, showing the video or the moments after a train collided with a car that was struck on the tracks, or stuck on the tracks, rather, in Broward County. This was Saturday night in Hallandale Beach. Wayne Jones was the good Samaritan in question. He says he saw a woman inside an SUV truck on the train tracks. Before he knew it, he said he just did what he could to try to save her. So I didn't hesitate. I left my car in the middle of Dixie Highway, and I ran across the railroad tracks to try to help her. There's another good Samaritan who's not been identified publicly, tried to use a truck to drag the SUV off the tracks, but they could hear and see this train coming towards them. Jones said, when the arms came down, I heard that ding, ding, ding. He said, it was time to get out of there. He said, I was like, forget the car. It's not going to make it. Let's just get her out of here. Jones says he feels bad about the damage to the SUV and the truck that was struck, but he says what matters most is that he, the other man who stopped to help, and the woman inside that SUV are all okay. He says, I wasn't trying to be a hero. I just reacted. You don't think twice. You just react. And I get that, right? I think very few of us in a situation like that would think, you know, here I come to save the day. But you do. It's instinctual, right? But not for everybody. Some folks' instincts are to freeze up. Some folks' instincts are to think, somebody else's responsibility. Somebody else is going to come to their aid. I don't know what to do. I'm not equipped for this. But then you got guys like Mr. Jones, who, again, instincts to run towards the danger, to help somebody in need. And for that, whether he likes to think of himself as a hero or not, we thank him for his very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Marion Arms Camp & Company. And I do want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. Be sure to check out the website throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation. If you like what you see, I would encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. Just go to BarionArms.com/subscribe. Use the promo code FIGHT, and you can get 60% off your membership. If you're a VIP Gold or Platinum member, you can get all kinds of great benefits. I mean, there are great benefits in every tier of support, but if you're a Gold or Platinum member, one of the benefits is you get to take part in our weekly live chats with all kinds of great town hall media personalities. But Wednesdays, 1:30 Eastern, it's usually Hot Airs and Morrissey and myself. Ed's out today, so it'll be Tom Knighton sticking here, filling in for Ed. And I'd love for you to be a part of these chats in the future. Also, I will throw this out here, shameless self-promotion time. The Gundy Awards are going on. You can vote now if you go to the Gundies, G-U-N-D-I-E-S, thegundies.com. Tom Knighton and John Petrolino, both up for best two-way writer. I know. I'm glad that they're both getting that recognition. I hate that I have to choose between one of them. I wish we had different categories of best two-way writer to pick from. Anyway, I am Barron Arms Camera Company, also up for a podcast of the year. I certainly would appreciate those votes. And again, I encourage you to vote for Tom and John and or John, whoever you choose. Maybe alternate John one day, Tom the next. You can vote once each per once every day in each of the 11 categories, but it's at the Gundies.com. So there you go. All right. Tomorrow, we'll be talking with Second Amendment attorney Daniel Schmutter from New Jersey. We'll talk about the amicus brief that he recently wrote in the Wolford versus Lopez case. Get his thoughts on what the rest of the Supreme Court's Second Amendment calendar is looking like. And maybe we'll talk about that gun ban case in New Jersey. We're still waiting on the Third Circuit now to issue its opinion. All expectations are New Jersey's gun ban is not long for this world. We'll get Dan's thoughts on that as well. Coming up on tomorrow's Greater Hunts Gaming Company. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Hump Day Wednesday. See you back here tomorrow. So then be well, be safe, and be free.